Welcome to Creaky Chair Film Podcast, the show where we discuss all things film, from the highest rated Elvis movies to the lowest rated Elvis movies, from King Creole, 6.9 on IMDb, to Stay Away Joe, 4.5.
Stay Away Joe.
Stay away from that one, Joe.
Yeah. Wow. There's quite a few hovering around that 4.5 mark.
I intend to watch all of them for this podcast.
Do you know what the plot of Stay Away Joe is? It sounds like a horror movie, but... Like it could be a new A24 spooky horror movie. So maybe it's ripe for a remake. Stay Away, Joe.
My name is Michael Brooks. I'm here with my co-hosts Bill King and Sam Oliver. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, bright and early,
Or good afternoon or evening to whenever you're listening, listeners. Good morning to you, Mitch, and you, Sam.
Episode 58, and still have not managed to get the standard podcast etiquette down.
We'll get there.
On this episode, we are talking about Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, starring Austin Butler and Tom Hanks. Before we get into talking about that, though, and what we thought about it, we've got a couple of items of news to reel off. So first bit of news for you. This has caused a fair bit of buzz over the last week or so. Which famous dancer has released their long-awaited spy thriller?
A spy thriller from a dancer? Whoa. Just a dancer?
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know if I know many dancers.
A famous dancer.
Oh, my gosh. Is it Anton DeBeck from Strictly Come Dancing?
Yeah.
Close.
Is it anyone from Strictly Come Dancing?
Strictly Come Spying.
Is it Len Goodman?
No.
Oh my gosh.
Is it
Len Goodman and Anton DeBeck working together?
It's good that you're both down on the Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh yeah. It's the only dancers I know.
Come on, you know this guy. You do know him.
I know him.
Michael Flatley.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Son of a bitch, really? He's in a spy thriller.
Michael Flatley. I can't believe it. I'm amazed that both of you have avoided this.
Tell me everything.
He has financed, written, directed, and is starring in a spy thriller called Blackbird, which I think it premiered at a film festival back in 2018, but it's been sort of and it caused a bit of a stir at the time, but it's now been released.
What, as a stir, and it's good? It's not.
No,
good, it?
No,
it's
it has been. It it's been garlanded with one-star reviews across the board. Mark Kermode called it one of the worst films ever made, and I think it's possibly destined to become a cult classic. I would suggest
it's a shit film, but he sure can dance.
Do you know that bit in I'm Alan Partridge, when Alan Partridge is pitching terrible ideas, a Michael Flatley spy thriller literally sounds like an Alan Partridge pitch, and I am here for it.
From what I've heard, I've listened to Kermode's review, and it basically sounds like he's done basically a Casablanca / James Bond type thing, and it's a complete vanity project for his fantasies, basically.
I mean... Because one part of it is, like, he's surely in pretty good shape because, you know, his feet are flames. He's the lord of the dance. So, I can see him being able to, like, dance around bullets and kick people. He's got high kicks, surely. So that side of it. But, I don't know. I'm not sure.
It sounds like he's taken it far too seriously. Whereas if he'd done, like, a really silly Michael Flatley as Michael Flatley dancing his way past criminals,
that could have really worked. Yeah, his feet are literally on fire the whole way through as well.
Yeah. If it had been like Ghost Rider, but with his feet rather than his entire body, Michael Flatley could have been onto a winner here.
God, I'm going to have to watch this film. I'm going to have to watch this. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to watch it.
We need an Ice Road Turkey to have as our worst film of 2022.
Yes,
not that we should prejudge. It might be great.
No. Good. It's vanity project.
Jump ahead a couple of episodes and we're like, guys, Mark Kermode is way too harsh on this absolutely joyous Michael Flatley
news
feature.
News past it. right, okay, second bit of news. Wow. Maybe slightly less horrifying, which childhood favourite is being corrupted into a forthcoming horror adaptation?
Oh, you sent us the trailer for this earlier and I haven't actually brought myself to watch it yet just because I can't quite cope with it.
I've watched the trailer. It's the lovely Winnie the Pooh.
Oh,
which doesn't make total sense.
Yeah. Of all the things to corrupt into a horror movie, Winnie the Pooh is... Oh,
yeah, so the trailer was released earlier this week of a new horror film titled Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. The loose plot is that Christopher Robin abandoned his 100-acre wood friends to go to college, and in his absence, they've basically gone feral. So Pooh and Piglet are now a vicious bear and pig who go around trying to find prey, and Christopher Robin is now returning home. So, I mean, the trailer looks brilliant, and I cannot wait to watch this. The release...
The trailer was great. When they find, like, Christopher Robin goes and he's like, he finds Eeyore's, like, remains. I think they've eaten Eeyore, haven't they? And then, like, the last bit is, like, this shitty, like, latex bear man coming up that looks like Winnie the Pooh, and then he's, Christopher Robin's like, we used to be friends!
I think we have to review this for this podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
The release is TBC at the moment. It has a distributor, but no release date. So hopefully that will be
coming. Winnie the Pooh's always been a bit creepy. I think he's always been a little bit off.
No, he's always been an absolute joyous, lovely little bear.
Nah,
it's all about fun and friendship and doing your best.
Never understood why it's called Pooh Sticks. Never understood why it's called the Pooh.
Because his name is Winnie the Pooh.
Why?
Why is your name William King?
Yeah, well, if I met a bear, it'd be William.
You're not a real king, are you?
No.
Your surname is King.
I'd just change it. I'd change it if I was called William Pooh.
Anyway, the reason why this has happened is because Winnie the Pooh is A.A. Milne's copyright lapsed into the public domain in January. So this is why it is now, you know, anyone can now corrupt or well, however way they like. And so I was thinking, what other childhood favourites are shortly due to be to forgo the same way? And Steamboat Willie is going to lapse into the public domain in 2024.
That close, so, is it? Fantastic. Ooh. Good. Yeah.
How long do you reckon it'll be before we can see like a really intense version of like Camberwick Green? I feel like Camberwick Green, like you can almost do a kind of like Wicker Man little provincial village thing, you know, but with the cast of Camberwick. Wendy Miller goes mad and just murders everyone.
I think there's so much. I think most things can be turned creepy when you think about it. Like Postman Pat goes rogue. Fireman Sam goes nuts. Thomas the Tank Engine's always been a bit fucked up. So that's right.
Got a little bit to work.
Okie doke. A little bit, but what about like 101 Dalmatians? Just like a load of 100 feral dogs just tearing people apart.
To be fair, like that could be like a remake of Cujo, but rather than it just being one angry dog, it is 101 angry dogs. Because then you couldn't just hide in your car to get away from that, could you? You'd have to really shoot them all in the head.
Begging to make them into coats.
Turn all dogs into coats.
Just before we get into talking about the film, so we need to mention that we are going to be reporting, well, Bill and Sam are going to be reporting from the field. So there is the Dead Northern Film Festival, which is a horror film festival, which is coming back, I think, for its third year, or I might be wrong. This is over the weekend of the 23rd to the 25th of September. It is in York, the lovely city of York. They've just released their programme. It's packed with new releases and a couple of world premieres, and they're also screening a couple of old favourites as well. So they're screening Dog Soldiers and 28 Days Later. As I say, I cannot make it, but Bill and Sam are going to be there on one of the days, and we'll report back on what they've seen in a special episode. So I think there's some tickets still available, so go to the Google Dead Northern Film Festival and you should be able to get your tickets.
We've not discussed this, but I've decided that when reporting on it, I'm going to be really using a really broad Northern accent just to get everyone into the spirit of being at a Dead Northern Film Festival. So, Bill, if you want to join me in being as Northern as possible, then I think that would be the right move in our field.
Right, good.
Reporting.
Right, good. Yeah, I'll work on that. I'm a little bit nervous because usually when I go to like horror film festivals, usually with you two, I get very scared. So I like hide and don't watch a load of stuff. Now I know I'm going to have to like have views on the films, so I'm forced to actually watch them. So this is going to be absolutely terrifying for me, but I'm doing it for you guys, listeners.
Thing is, though, that could almost be a good kind of like metric. So if you're like, I stopped watching it from about 20 minutes in because I was really scared, people would be like, all right, cool. It sounds like it's well worth my time.
Little
so it could have gone downhill.
I get scared very easily, but they don't know that.
Yeah, we'll have to get like a bar of what easily scared, how easily scared you are, and then where you'll sit on that. We'll work something out.
Yeah, we'll work on it as we work on our Yorkshire accents.
I'm going to be very, well, I'll be jealous anyway to be missing out, but I will be immensely jealous if the secret screening is the premiere of Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. Oh,
yes, please. Yes, please. Or I think if it's the Michael Flatley film, they class it as a horror, it's so bad. I'm happy with either.
Either way, if that does happen, I think you'll have to, I don't know how you'll get there that fast. Maybe hire a private jet or something, but you'll need to get to York ASAP.
Yeah.
You're worth it.
Okay, right. So this episode, we are talking about Elvis. This is the new life story of Elvis Presley from Baz Luhrmann, director behind films such as Romeo and Juliet and The Great Gatsby and Moulin Rouge. So this film is told from the perspective of Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, played by Tom Hanks, who is this kind of carnival operator who becomes Elvis's manager as Elvis soars towards superstardom and notoriety. And the film covers almost the whole of Elvis's life. So it sort of starts from the first recordings that he cut with Sam Phillips at Sam Studios in Memphis through to his marriage to Priscilla, played by Olivia de Jong, I think is how you pronounce her name, the 1968 revival, the Vegas years, and his untimely death in 1977. So ground sweep of Elvis's life. This premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in May of this year and was released in the cinema in July. And at the time of recording, it's currently the second highest grossing music biopic of all time behind Bohemian Rhapsody. So it has been doing great business. I am due to go first this week. Start with my thoughts. I'm not going to be saying anything unique if I say that this is flashy and intoxicating and exhilarating. There were times when watching this felt like being quite drunk, but you wouldn't expect anything less from Baz Luhrmann, would you? I mean, you know, this is what he does and does it very, very well. Austin Butler as Elvis, I thought, was mostly brilliant. I mean, I thought there are times as young Elvis where he looked a little bit wooden, but I think by the time it gets to the NBC 68 special and then the Vegas period, I mean, he's almost indistinguishable. It's quite remarkable. Where I thought it kind of lacked was the final Elvis period, so I don't think he looked ill or bloated enough in the final scenes. But on the whole, I thought, yeah, there's a lot been said about Butler's performance. I think he was generally knocked it out of the park. I mean, I'm quite a big fan of Elvis. I mean, annoying humble brag alert. I've been to a few of the key locations that are in the film, so Sun Studios and Beale Street, Memphis and Graceland. But I'm by no means an Elvis aficionado. But that said, as far as I could tell from what I know, I mean, it was very broadly accurate and true to the facts. Maybe some slight liberties taken here and there, but I mean, only maybe a real Elvis expert would be able to distinguish. But by and large, I think it was very faithful to reality. And also, I thought did a good job of not shying away from some of the difficulties in his later life, so the drug abuse and the infidelities. I thought maybe it could have been a little bit more unvarnished around that, but you know, I think it would be hard to be disappointed by its rendering of the events. I think it's probably as good a telling of Elvis's whole life story as you'll get. I mean, it goes at such a breakneck pace. I mean, it barely seems to pause for breath, which inevitably it kind of feels like there's many parts of his life that are skirted over or not given adequate weight. Particularly, I thought his early years before he made that first record, that's kind of quite thin. Pretty much the whole of the 1960s is raced over in less than 5 minutes is when he's making the increasingly shit films. I mean, it's both exhilarating and breathlessly fun to watch, but it all makes it sort of feel slightly empty from time to time. I thought, you know, like at the end of the 60s when he's kind of lamenting his, you know, being a has-been, it kind of feels a little bit like it was only a few minutes since he was being threatened with jail for being too provocative. So the time is a little bit too compressed. I thought the portrayal of Colonel Tom Parker, I mean, he's absolutely the villain of the story, isn't he? I mean, I felt like this was a little bit of a shallow, almost cartoonish portrayal. And I don't think that's necessarily Hanks's fault. Maybe it was just something to do with the script and, like I said, the pacing. Like towards the end, when there's that kind of emotional, you know, spoiler alert, but yeah, there's this kind of emotional confrontation with Elvis where he says, "You, we were a partnership," and I sort of, you don't really get that sense from the film's narrative, because it sort of comes across like you have someone with an extraordinary gift and talent, and then someone who basically sought to just put his face on aprons and scarves. I don't really, you really get the impression that somehow he crafted and steered Elvis's journey. It rather felt a lot more exploitative. And again, that maybe is, as I say, the uncomfortable side effect of trying to condense so much into 2.5 hours. I mean, Lerman has said apparently that there's a 4-hour version. I think that might be a slightly preferable running time to try and get a bit more space. I thought the use of music throughout was really well done. There's kind of new versions and old are kind of woven throughout. I thought that worked really well. I was initially a bit worried when I read that Elvis's vocals, at least young Elvis, were going to be provided by Austin Butler, because I mean, no one sounds like Elvis Presley does, but I thought he did a terrific job, and it didn't really take me out of the film at all. So that was a really pleasant surprise. I think it's one of the best films I've seen in like capturing and expressing the sheer excitement of music. I mean, some of those scenes on Beale Street and the scene with Little Richard and some of the recording session scenes, it's just pure excitement emanating from the screen, and it just felt, as I said, really quite intoxicating. I thought the final scene where there's the real footage of Elvis in Vegas singing Unchained Melody, really quite powerful and affecting. I mean, that's quite rare to see, apparently. So like Elvis's estate are quite protective about allowing footage of him in his overweight, ill state to be officially released. So I was quite surprised to see that in this project. I thought that was just the right way to end the film. I thought it was very poignant. So overall, I mean, not without its flaws or things that I wish had been done a little bit differently, but this is still really a very electrifying film and such fun. I thought Butler was terrific. And yeah, if you're, you know, it's well worth watching if you're a huge Elvis fan or if you just don't know anything about him. So yeah, quite a big thumbs up from me, I think. Sam, you are going next.
Yeah, to be honest, I am probably going to be singing from a very similar hymn sheet to the one that Michael just sang from. I have to admit to not being particularly, not necessarily not fond of Elvis before this movie, but I just didn't really know all that much about him beyond the very kind of surface level understanding of the hits, basically, and kind of knowing Elvis as this weird kind of like cultural icon. So I was really intrigued to go into this movie because I think other musical biopics that I've loved and enjoyed before were of artists that I kind of had a conception of beforehand, or I had like my own opinions of them and their music. Johnny Cash, the Walk the Line biopic being a good example, and a Brian Wilson one that Paul Dano and John Cusack were in being others. But this one I kind of was going in being like, okay, Elvis is this almost like otherworldly, godly figure in music. Let's kind of see what's the man behind the legend, as it were. And I thought it was a fantastic rendering of that. The way that it's shot in this kind of frenetic, hyper kind of like music video style almost makes the film feel far shorter than its running time is, because it is just over 2 hours, I think, but it absolutely zips by. Obviously, they've got all of Elvis's all too short 42 years to cram into it, so there obviously is a lot to be getting on with. The film feels constantly pressed for time and feels like it's constantly got the other things to move on to. And obviously, I had the similar thoughts to you, Michael, about I'm kind of fascinated by his weird film period, and I was a bit disappointed that that wasn't given more thrift, especially, again, I'm just echoing you here, but to then go into a scene where he's really lamenting the fact he is a has-been, whereas from your perspective as watching the film, you're like, I've only ever seen you go from strength to strength to strength. So let's see what that 4-hour edit has. Maybe it'll have loads of like Blue Hawaii scenes and we can all have a lovely time watching that. I thought the choice to kind of frame Elvis's whole story through the lens of Colonel Manager Tom Parker Hanks was really inspired, because it, as I said, like going into this, Elvis has always felt like a kind of distant, otherworldly figure to me. And I think seeing his story told through someone else that was obviously very close to him almost kept that mystery and that weirdness and that kind of like uncertainty around Elvis as a figure. It's kind of keeps him, whilst you do get to know him a lot, and obviously you see what made him who he was, seeing his story kind of like from the person that was, apart from his wife and mother and family, closest to him, I thought was a really inspired choice to kind of like keep him at this sort of like on the pedestal sort of nature. As you mentioned, Austin Butler is incredible. There's a chance that he might have made a deal with the devil to become actual Elvis for a lot of those scenes there. He was absolutely fantastic and properly carried this the whole movie for me. I think a lot of other great music biopics, there's really good supporting cast, and this film has a fantastic supporting cast. But Elvis being this figure of like absolute musical history, and I think he still is the highest selling solo artist of all time or something ridiculous. You need this big performance. And I think it's a bold decision from Baz Luhrmann to go for Austin Butler, who has, I don't think, been in much before this at all. I think he was in that Jim Jarmusch zombie movie that wasn't particularly great. So I think it's such a bold choice to give this huge, like, important performance to a new talent who absolutely smashes it out of the park. It was also lovely to see Tom Hanks playing a proper villain. I feel like we discussed this a while ago on that News of the World episode that Bill loved the film and wouldn't stop talking about how great it was. It's really nice to see lovely everyone's uncle Tom Hanks being a real villainous character. If anything, I kind of wanted them to go a little bit deeper with it, because you do get the sense that he is the true horrible villain of this story. And inevitably, because it's a Tom Hanks performance, you can't fully hate him and you kind of need to fully hate him. So, you know, it's nice to see Tom Hanks do that, but obviously he, just by his very nature of being lovely, does stop you from going all the way to being like, he's a full scumbag. The Las Vegas montage stuff at the end, because that's the part of Elvis's story that I have no real understanding of. I knew that he is synonymous with Las Vegas, but I didn't know that he basically was held prisoner there for the waning years of his life. And I just thought, like, all of those, the Las Vegas montage of him getting more and more, you know, addled with like drugs and all of the difficulties that he was having, and his performances getting sweatier and more panicky, and that bit where he deep throated the mic was really funny. I really enjoyed that. But just seeing that kind of like descent was incredible, and the way that it was all framed at the end just brought everything together in this really beautiful and horrifying way. I thought it was absolutely amazing. So yeah, it's, speaking as someone who before this film didn't really care all that much about Elvis, this film really made me care about Elvis. It really kind of absolutely got to me. And by the end of it, I was 100% like, I think I might be a massive Elvis fanboy now. And I think that's all that a music biopic needs to do, really, doesn't it? If you don't know or have any preconceptions beyond the very base level, which is what I had coming out of it, being like, I need to go and listen to some more Elvis Presley, is more praise than I think a film, than a music biopic. That's what you're going for, isn't it? To kind of get people excited about the musician and get people excited about music. So yeah, I think there is flaws in the film. I'd genuinely love to see a 4-hour cut of it, which speaks a lot of, as a film that I wasn't that keen on going in, that I now want to see twice as much as I did before. But yeah, it's a fantastic music biopic. It's a fantastic film. And yeah, Austin Butler, I think, might actually be Elvis Presley. So that's great. Good for him. So yeah, I'm just echoing Michael's thoughts, but yeah, I didn't have a suspicious mind about it.
I was literally about to say, I was really impressed with like none of us doing an Elvis impression or reference so far. And then just right at the end, he couldn't help himself.
Oh, we should have seen who can squeeze as much Elvis titles into our reviews.
I was gonna start with an Elvis impression and end with the pun, so at least I was half restrained, you know.
Bill, go on, see how many titles you can get into your reviews.
I struggle a lot with most musical biopics. I haven't liked many of the more modern ones. I haven't really enjoyed them, especially
which
when
ones
they've been
are you
hyped
thinking
up.
Of?
Like, I didn't like Bohemian Rhapsody. I wasn't engrossed by, like, Walk the Line. They're the two just off the top of my head. And they were massively hyped up. And with the central performances, they
were...
Have
you seen Rocketman?
No, I've avoided that. I've avoided that because I just didn't fancy it. This one was likewise hyped up. And I really enjoyed it. I basically agree with everything you two said. I loved it. Had a great time. Baz Luhrmann, again, a director I've struggled with in the past, but for all his idiosyncrasies as a director, I think he was pretty much perfect for this, because he's got the visual flair, as we were talking about, and sort of just off the wall madness, and it almost feels like it's improvisation, even though I know it's not, it's lots of effects and whatnot, but it feels improvisational and it feels a bit crazy. And I think that's perfect to inject a lot of fun and energy into what I think with a music biopic is quite a tired and rote formula. You know, it's a lot of them have the similar sort of stories, you know, the rise and fall, you know, young kid that's really into music. That's his outlet. He goes through and then he eventually gets pressed down by the music industry and then dies very, very sadly. You know, that's most of the stories on there. And then it's the same in this one, but there was so much fun and flair and craziness. I thought that was great. I think it also helps that Elvis and the Colonel are such big, larger than life characters. You know, they're more caricatures than characters, really. I didn't feel we got under the skin of either of them, to be honest. But as Sam said, that's kind of fine because they kept this like godlike aura around Elvis, and you know, he was one of a kind. So that's a fine. There are other Elvis biopics, I'm sure, and there are other biopics which get under the skin and find out what really make this guy tick. Whereas this was basically telling the story of some ethereal being that was brought down by the devil, who was the Colonel. So I didn't care. They were entertainers, as was kept pressed to the audience, and I was entertained. The performance is brilliant. Again, larger than life, especially in Tom Hanks' case. But then when you go and watch footage of the Colonel, that's how he looked and sounded. And as the film says, a lot of what he was doing was an act because of, I won't spoil too much if you don't know it, but there was more to him than met the eye. And I thought that was absolutely fine. And again, with Butler, he was just raw and pretty revelatory, real star-making turn. As Michael said, I struggled a little bit in the earlier scenes when he was younger. But by the time he was Elvis in the Berlin stage where he went to the army, there was times I was looking at a screen and it was just seeing Elvis. Like, he really looked, sounded, and it just seemed like I was watching actual footage. And I think that was really impressive. And likewise with Tom Hanks, even though I knew it was Tom Hanks, I sort of forgot because he was playing such a different role and the accent was so weird and his bodily transformation or whatever they'd done with prosthetics was great. I was worried at the start whether Lerman was just going to disappear into craziness when he kept doing absolutely wild transitions of roulette wheel to eye to whatever, bowling ball or whatever, and it was just going crazy. I was like, this is too much, but that was kind of cool because it was showing how that lifestyle, showbiz is too much, Vegas is too much, the drugs were too much, the adoring fans, you know, when he shot the scenes where it was basically like this riot was going to take place where women were basically spontaneously combusting as he moved his pelvis, I thought that was fantastic. And I was sat in a Everyman cinema, and I could see other people, not just women around me, having the same reaction to Austin Butler. So that shows you what a star-making turn. Indeed, I was. Let's be honest, guys. The music, I didn't like the modern remixes too much, but I think that's more just a me thing. I think I'm a bit of a purist, and I love Elvis music so much. I was a bit like, oh, just play the originals. But I get why they did it. I get it made it relevant. It really helped in those scenes where Elvis was struggling, was going back down to his roots. I thought that was fine. But then when it stuck to Elvis and the way they did the performance is absolutely great. I think the musical numbers were so great and the performance was so great. I wanted to get out of my seat. You know, I could feel like my legs started tapping, and I think it's as close to a gig as I've gotten in a cinema. I felt that post gig high when I came out. So it's probably the closest I'll get to seeing Elvis, unless he really isn't dead, as some believe. And the film glossed over the alien abduction theories. But yeah, I think that's the highest praise I can give it. It felt like a gig. It felt like I got to see Elvis performances. So yeah, really, really enjoyed it. Pretty exhilarating. And I too would like to see 4 hours of it. Although I might spontaneously combust. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Sorry, just to going back on what you were saying, going back to something you were saying at the start, Bill, about other music biopics. I think I was thinking about it as you were talking, because I have a similar thought with like Bohemian Rhapsody. And like, I really love Queen. I think they're fantastic. My dad, like, I grew up listening to Queen through my dad. And I think the problem with Bohemian Rhapsody compared to Elvis is that Bohemian Rhapsody is all about, like, look how good Rami Malek is as Freddie Mercury. And he is fantastic as Freddie Mercury. But the film around it is boring. The film that's kind of around that incredible performance doesn't do justice to Queen and doesn't do justice to, like, the band, it's just like they put all their energy into how good Rami Malek is. Whereas this film, I think, obviously Austin Butler does an incredible performance as Elvis, but the film around it, Baz Luhrmann kind of like crafts, so like, what is Elvis? What is the experience I'm telling here? What's the story? And it gives you, like you said, that gig experience of like, I'm tapping my toes, I'm going to combust, look at his pelvis. Whereas Bohemian Rhapsody is just like, isn't Freddie Mercury, isn't Rami Malek Freddie Mercury? That's good. And you're like, yes, but I need more.
I think it also helped. It also helped that you had this focal point in that you had Elvis as the good guy and you had a villain. You know, that's important in many stories, and you didn't have that in Bo Rap. So, you know, you've got the Colonel to focus as this villainous character that is the focal point for all the negatives there. So, yeah, it all shook up the musical biopic.
I will say I've not seen actually many of those modern ones, but one that's just popped into my head that is very, very good is the Control, the Anton Corbijn film about Ian Curtis and Joy Division, which is absolutely fantastic. Nice. Yeah. So there are some gems out there.
I've not seen that one. Yeah. That's high on my list.
I'll give it a whirl.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, Sam? Like you say, you came at it from a different sort of perspective from Bill and I, who were kind of keen on the music. You didn't really know too much about him. I mean, I was in a quite busy cinema. I had a woman on my left who was probably in her mid-70s and two girls on my right who were probably around 14, 15. And it's kind of like interesting kind of crossover appeal, cross-generational appeal. I wish I'd been too weird to have turned to them at the end. What did you think? But, you know, interesting, isn't it? I wonder what the people from different age ranges kind of take from it or what they learn from it about Elvis, and you know, it's a unique kind of appeal.
But I think that's the really interesting thing about Elvis in general, is that like he is such a kind of huge musical icon that has influenced probably every musician working today, and the kind of modern remixes of the songs that were in the film kind of highlight that point of like Elvis is timeless, like he was this kind of like one shot kind of experience. So yeah, it is kind of cool that there is this film that people of all age ranges are like, yeah, I want to see what this Elvis fella is all about. And those sexy pelvises are appealing to 70-year-olds or to Bill and people in the everyman, you know.
Well, there we go. That's a fairly strong three thumbs up from the creaky chair panel here.
Three pelvises. Yeah. Oh, three pelvises.
My pelvis is up.
It may still be out. I think it's still out in cinemas at the moment. If you can go and see it, well advised to do so in a cinema because it does look fantastic on the big screen. Mm-hmm. We're going to now talk about what else we've been watching, and I'm not going to be deviating very far. So what I've been watching is, Bill, you mentioned that there probably has been other Elvis biopics, and yes, there is. There is one from 1979 by none other than John Carpenter. So this is the film that John Carpenter made a year after. Yeah, I know. He made this a year after he made Halloween. And it's sort of an anomaly in his career. And it's also the first film that he made with Kurt Russell, who stars as Elvis. And that would be I was amazed to learn this myself. Obviously, Kurt Russell and John Carpenter went on to make a whole string of great films through the 1980s, but this was their first collaboration. This is very interesting to watch alongside Baz Luhrmann's interpretation because it largely tracks, obviously, the same stories and the same events, although Carpenter's film is an incomplete story, so it ends with Elvis in Vegas in 1970, kind of, you know, beginning that decline. I guess maybe it was too soon to cover his whole life and death, given that Elvis had only died in 1977. It was a bit too soon, perhaps. This was made for it was broadcast on the ABC network, so it does have a sort of televisual style to it. It's more workmanlike. There's not anywhere near as many thrills or cinematic visuals, which is a real contrast to Luhrmann's film. And it doesn't have anything really that would identify it as being a John Carpenter film. He didn't have any control over the edit, which he said he found disappointing. Where its strengths lie, I think, it is in the largely faithful telling of the Elvis story. There's more time spent in his childhood and his family life. So you get Shirley Winters is really good as his doting mother. And Kurt Russell's father actually plays Elvis's father. So you get more of that family background. You get a little bit more under the skin. And it also, what also works well is like the running time. So this is 168 minutes, which is about, I think, 15, 20 minutes longer than Baz Luhrmann's film. And the pacing feels much more satisfactory. There's more, there's none of the full throttle speeding through whole chunks of his life. It's much more even. You do get more of that, the 60s, when he starts making the films. The other strength is Kurt Russell's performance. I mean, he's really good, and it's a very well-rounded performance, particularly in his younger years as well. So I think Russell looks a lot more like Elvis than Butler does in those early years. So both Russell and Butler give excellent performances, but kind of in slightly different ways. So it's a different kind of film. It's much less flashy, much less cinematic, less focused on Colonel Parker, but it's well worth watching nonetheless. You know, if you've seen Luhrmann's film, want to check this out, yeah, well, definitely do. There's a lot to recommend it. So that's, yeah, the overlooked, I would say, John Carpenter's Elvis from 1979.
I genuinely did not know that that was a thing. That's amazing. Wow. Learning something new every day.
Yeah, yeah. Sam, what are you seeing?
Do you know what? I was going, literally, I narrowed my thoughts for what we're watching down to two. And the other option, besides the one that I'm going to talk about, was The Thing. I was going to talk about the John Carpenter, Kurt Russell film, The Thing, which maybe subconsciously I knew that you'd also planned a John Carpenter, Kurt Russell. I didn't want to seem like this whole thing is staged, so I've moved away. But wow, there's the mental connections we've got going on here. Why this is a great podcast. Thank you for listening. What I'm talking about today is... So it's a documentary series that was originally released as a kind of full film, but then then was put on Netflix as a really great little three-parter. And it's the series Five Came Back. It's available on Netflix, and it's based on a book called Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. So the film is about these five iconic Golden Age Hollywood directors who, during World War II, went off to... rather than to go off to fight, went off with their cameras and did what they do best and made movies and made films to show people back home the reality of the war. And it really is iconic Hollywood directors. You've got the five directors featured are Frank Capra, John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston and William Wyler. So some real heavy hitters there. The film is directed by a French director whose name I'm about to utterly butcher, Lauren Buzerier, didn't do very well in GCSE French, as you can tell, and narrated by the much easier to pronounce Meryl Streep. It's fantastic. The documentary just marries together a lot of my personal fave interests. There's World War II, there's archive footage, there's the Golden Age of Hollywood, there's Steven Spielberg chatting about how much he loves films, and most importantly, there's a big section towards the end about how great It's a Wonderful Life is. So it's just ticking all my boxes. So yeah, the series focuses on these directors and their kind of careers leading up to the Second World War, and then obviously America's entry into the Second World War after Pearl Harbor, and then the films that they went off to go and make in various kind of different theatres of conflict all around the world during the Second World War. And it's just fascinating. Obviously, World War II is such a huge, in case you didn't know, was a big war. It's this huge, expansive conflict that spans everywhere. And all of these directors all went off to different places to cover different aspects of the war, from battles in the South Pacific to the kind of conflict back home. It's got lots of really great talking head interviews with Steven Spielberg, Lawrence Kasdan, Francis Ford Coppola, Paul Greengrass, and Guillermo del Toro. And it shows you lots of the clips of the movies that they made. It's really cool because it was such a... these kind of huge name directors. It reminded me, actually, of in Elvis, when obviously Elvis, at the height of his fame, went off to Berlin to do like army service for a while, how mad an idea that is. And this film, this series, really captures the idea of how crazy it would be if, like, Christopher Nolan was like, I'm going to sack off making Oppenheimer and go and film stuff in Ukraine. Like, what a mad thing that is. So yeah, it's a fantastic series. If you're interested in World War II or cinema or both, it marries those two things together beautifully. Also on Netflix, they've put up a lot of the films that the directors actually made, a lot of the kind of propaganda movies that they made about all aspects of the war. There's two particularly that I'd highly recommend. William Wyler made a film called The Memphis Belle, A Story of a Flying Fortress, which is about this big, huge ship that went on bombing raids over Germany. And he filmed it kind of like in the actual ships that were going to war. It's insane. And also John Huston made a film after the war called Let There Be Light, which was all about soldiers coming back from war and dealing with PTSD. And it's heartbreaking, but also heartwarming. It's great. Yeah. So that's Five Came Back. It's available on Netflix. And yeah, if you like World War II or Hollywood, what more could you want? Yeah. Maybe next time we'll talk about The Thing. What? See how I feel.
That sounds really interesting. Yeah. Is that Bristol brand new, did you say?
I think it was out a couple of years ago. I can't, like 2017 possibly. But I think I watched it when it first came out. And then I was just scrolling through the other day and I was like, oh, do you know what? Mm. So I watched it twice now. So what more recommendation might you need? Yeah. But then, you know, I am a huge nerd for Steven Spielberg talking about how much he loves films. So
what more could I want? That's an endorsement. Yeah.
And what did Frank Capra do to it? Because It's a Wonderful Life came out pretty much the year after, didn't it?
Yeah, that's the really sad thing. It's basically talking about how he made a whole series of films called Why We Fight, which was released, and they were shown as like newsreels before films. And he made this whole series that was just talking about the war in general. And obviously he made all these things. Everyone was like, whoa, thanks, Frank Capra. You've really brought the war home to all these people. And then he was like, cool, I'm back now. I've just made It's a Wonderful Life. And everyone was like, no, thanks. So it's lots of really sad interviews of people being like, how crap must it have been to come back from the fucking Second World War and make arguably your best film ever? And everyone was like, nah, I'm all right, thanks. So, yeah. But yeah, Frank Capra, a couple of the Frank Capra ones are available on Netflix as well. If you just search Five Came Back, there'll be the series and then the actual films as well. It's great.
Excellent. That's a top shout. Bill, round us off. What have you seen?
I went for a brand spanking new film this week. I went for 13 Lives, which has just come out, directed by Ron Howard, stars Viggo Mortensen, Colin Farrell, Patacorn, Tang Sepokul, Joel Edgerton and Sukulawat Kanarot. And this is the true story of the Tam Luang cave rescue of 12 boys and their football coach in Thailand, which happened in 2018. I went into this one not with high expectations again, because I think we all followed the story pretty closely. You couldn't not. It was everywhere at the time. And some of us, me included, pretty obsessively followed the news as it unfolded. So I didn't think there'd be anything that had really grab or surprise me about this. But yeah, I was pretty 100% wrong. I think Ron Howard is becoming the modern master of the disaster movie, because between this and Apollo 13, I think are two of the modern really, really good examples of the genre. Absolutely nail-biting. The tension of this impossible situation is kept ratcheted through all the way through. It's kind of unbearable at times because you are just there and you're just thinking this situation is just getting worse and worse. How the hell are they going to solve this? And it just looks, the entire rescue just looks horrendous for everybody involved. But it also does a really admirable job of explaining all the different facets to the rescue attempt and the difficulties. You know, I think it'd be an easy film if you just concentrated on the divers and the diving rescue, but it's about the volunteers working to block the sinkholes higher up the mountain because the rain is cascading in as engineers are trying to pump the water back out of the cave. Farmers sacrificing their crops, the political side of it as well, governors getting blamed, the Thai Navy SEALs being a bit proud and not automatically trusting these British divers that are brought in. And the British divers played by Mortensen and Farrell are brilliant. What's really great about the performance is they don't try and make these real life guys they're playing any more heroic or even cooler than these guys actually are. Because these guys are basically nerds that love cave diving and are incredibly good at it. And they were asked and they thought they could help. They're not doing this from any like it's our duty to do this. They're just like, well, I think there's certain issues about going in this cave, and if I go through the left hand and you regulate your breathing this way. And they're more obsessed with custard creams than they are actually the huge undertaking. It's done very well. Their accents, which are from middle-earing England, are just perfect. And nothing's over-egged. There's no aggrandizing or overwrought sentiment. Sentiment does obviously come into it when they do find the boys and they are a little bit in awe of how well they've survived down there. It does creep in, and it depicts them shock afterwards really well. But it isn't. There's no grand speeches. There's no, we have to do this. They're just getting on with the job and looking at it like a problem that needs to be worked out. The cave scenes are incredibly uncomfortable to watch. It's awful to watch, to be honest. It's incredibly claustrophobic. Every scrape of the oxygen tank could mean death. Every wrong turn is catastrophic. You know, these guys are swimming for 6 hours through these narrow passages, and it just looks like the worst thing in the world. I can't believe the guys did it for fun as a hobby and then do these rescues as well. The entire operation is ludicrous when it actually came to pass, because I was sat there and I was thinking, if this wasn't true, I'd be saying this is just too silly and unbelievable. Like, this is one step too far. But yeah, it is true. And it's also very accurate. It shows the warts and all situation. It's not a case of look how brilliant everyone is. But I think it does. It is a nice story. You know, it's one of those stories where you're just like, yeah, good. Human beings have overcome this pest situation and helped out. So it's a fun story to watch from that side, and a great story about human endeavor, but incredibly, incredibly uncomfortable. And I'm not sure I'll be rushing to watch it again, just because afterwards I was feeling just a little bit claustrophobic and thinking I don't even want to get in a bath again in case the ceiling slowly starts to close down on me like Indiana Jones. So yeah, I'd recommend it. Really, really awesome watch. But yeah, if you are suffering a little bit with claustrophobia, maybe steer clear. And that's 13 Lives, and that's available on Amazon Prime.
I was just going to ask whether they feature Elon Musk at any point.
No, he's conspicuous by his absence. I don't think he needed any more airtime. Yeah, as I said, it's all pretty much business. I don't think we needed anyone there that was just for show and or throwing slurs around. So, yeah, Elon was pretty conspicuously cut on the cutting room floor.
Great news. Smart decision.
Yeah.
I feel like I really would like to see this movie, but I think my claustrophobia is keeping me from it, and hearing some of the specifics is now really making me think, like, am I strong enough to watch this? I don't think I possibly am.
It's tough. Like, if you've seen The Descent, which is the other film I think that steers close to it, you know, with the scraping of the helmets on the cave walls, it is, like, I didn't think I'd find it as tough as I did. Like, ooh. It really shows. Just, and you know, there was fatalities during the rescue, and that comes across, but it just looks incredibly shit thing to do. And I can't believe some people, as I say, some people do it for fun. You I'm really glad you saved those lads. Well done, boys, but you fucking idiots.
Doing it for saving those boys and loads of custard creams, I assume. So
custard creams are a very important plot point. And yeah, that's one thing. Yeah, you come out of it incredibly claustrophobic and wanting a custard cream. So there's pros and cons.
You know.
Did you also say that you've been to see Prey?
I have been to see Prey, yeah. Yeah, I've not made any notes about it, but do you want a quick little review?
Your 30-second review?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed it. It shook up the Predator. I'm a big Predator fan. It shook up the Predator setup pretty well. I thought the star of it, I think she's called Amber Midthunter. I think I might have got that wrong. Sorry, listeners. But she actually was in The Ice Road. And it's really good she's now able to be in a good film. No, it was interesting. I liked the way it was all slipped on his head, that it was a inexperienced hunter trying to prove herself to this Comanche tribe, and it was an inexperienced predator. Yeah, really, really cool. I really enjoyed it and would recommend Prey.
Well, there we are. Brilliant.
In case you're wondering, Michael,
Yes.
I would also recommend The Thing. The Thing's good as well. Just in case you're wondering about other things, The Thing's good.
Really ending on a hot take
alert from me, but yeah. John Carpenter's The Thing is good.
And I mean, that's 1982, right? So that's only 3 years after Elvis, and Kurt Russell's absolutely transformed in those 3 years, isn't he?
Wow. Did it take him 3 years to grow that a magnificent beard? Maybe.
Probably, yeah. Right, well, there we go. What an excellent episode. Lots of really good films to check out or revisit. Next episode, we are going to be talking about Jordan Peele's third film, the guy behind Get Out and Us. He's back with a sci-fi horror, Nope. Yeah, check in with us and see what we thought about that. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Sam. I'll speak to you then.
Pleasure as always.
Creaky Chair has left the building.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Creaky Chair Film Podcast. If you like what you heard, it'd mean the world to us if you told someone about the show.
Tell them about it even if you hated it.
Or even if you just felt really apathetic about it.
Yeah, there's no such thing as bad press.
If you can leave us a review on wherever you're listening, that'd be amazing.
And don't forget, we're on all of the social media things.
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, Bebo, MSN Messenger.
And that's at Creaky Chair Pod on Instagram and at Creaky Chair on Twitter.
And if you search Creaky Chair Film Podcast on Facebook, you'll find us there too.
You can even email us at creakychairfilmpodcast@gmail.com if you want to send us your essay about how much we were well out of order with the ice road.